Hi, I'm Edwina Gokian, and you're listening to The Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list though, wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days, 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it, you've got to keep giving yourself challenges.
And welcome to the next episode of the Breffni Early Show. This week, we have someone who's a little bit closer to home. We're still in the confines of County Leitrim, and I'm joined by the beautiful Edwina Gokian. Edwina, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Breffni.
People might not be that familiar with you, but they may have heard of you before. You've been, you've flirted with stardom on a national level on a couple of times back. I'm thinking back to the All-Ireland Talent Show back in 2010 with the Shannon O'Sullivan and Shannon. You've also been on the stage in the Dome in Tralee as a Rose back in 2013. And very well known around these parts, of course. But you also run your own dance school.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've been on several different stages doing several different things and different types of shoes, from dancing shoes to high heels.
Yeah, and obviously, of course, you've also been part of a viral video where you shared a year of your life in 2013, including your own engagement.
Yes, yeah.
Brave move.
Yeah, it wasn't planned. It wasn't. He surprised me for my 1 second a day.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to bring it back a bit because obviously, as you said to me off air beforehand, you grew up dancing. It's been your life since you were knee height to a grasshopper. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what effect dancing has had in your life.
Well, it's not really, as I tell everyone that asks me about dance, it wasn't that I was brought to dancing classes or anything like that. It was just a way of life. So my mother danced, and my grandfather and all his family all play music, and some of his family danced as well. And really, it wasn't something I was ever forced into. We just got up and danced in the kitchen at home, or Granda would play a tune and we danced to that. And that's really how it developed. You know, it was enjoyable.
It wasn't, let's say, for example, people, when they think of Irish dance, they think of river dance. What you do isn't necessarily that line of dancing, or am I wrong on that?
No, it's complete opposite of river dance. It's Shannon's dancing was my main form of dance that I started off with, which would be, it's a really new term, Shannon's, even though it means old style. It's only been called that on my style of dance for maybe the past 10 to 15 years. But previous to that, it was just dancing. So a lot of people refer to it as what the old men used to get up and do in the pubs years ago. But yeah, it's just been a really, it's a really relaxed, loose style of dance. A lot of it is on improvisation and spontaneity, and really about working one-to-one with your musician that you're dancing with. It's not something that, if you were to keep to its true style, that you can do in a group. It's very much something that you do by yourself with the musician.
So no two dances are the same?
Nope, never. If you ask me to dance right now and dance 2 minutes later, I wouldn't have a clue what I just did the previous minute before that.
So that's very different to, I'm thinking at the moment, stuff that's cool is Dancing at the Stars in the US, mm-hmm. or Strictly Come Dancing in the UK, and people are, it's very formulaic and very formatted.
Yeah,
it's not like that at all.
It's not at all, and that's one thing I find really difficult when I work in shows, is having to learn an actual routine and work with other dancers.
You must be a director. A choreographer's nightmare.
I can't remember. And the other, but there are like advantages to it, because then I work a lot with Irish dancers touring with different shows, and sometimes a band might shout at you from the sidelines saying, get out there and dance 16 bars quickly, whatever you want, and I can run out and do whatever I want. But the Irish dancers usually have a panic attack side stage going, what are we going to do? So that's the advantage of me. But when I have to dance with other people, the thinking has to go on.
So mid-teens, mm-hmm. you've been dancing since year one, mm-hmm. And now, well, since you can walk,
yeah.
And now you want to share that with other people, so you set up your own dance classes, basically.
Yeah, I was 16 when I set them up. It was, yeah, it was, I was in secondary school, and I had so many people from around the area asking me would I do classes and teach their children how to dance. So I started when I was 16 on Saturdays inside in St. Mary's Hall in Carrick and Shannon, and I'm still there. 14 years later?
No, don't age yourself. You're not 30 just yet.
Okay. Well, then a wee bit younger. So 12. 12 years. But yeah, it was good. I was really glad I did it. It was never something that I had planned to turn into what it is today. You know, it just kind of happened from one stage to another. And I love that. just naturally progressed that way rather than me being really like determined at 16 to this is what I'm going to do. I was glad that it happened more naturally.
Okay, so 18 years of age, do your leaving cert, you go to university, mm-hmm. went to Pats, studied teaching.
Yeah.
Was dancing a part of your life in Pats, or was that more the traditional student lifestyle?
No, I was still teaching dancing when I was in St. Pat's. So I was in Show MacArthur there. And yeah, oh God, yeah. I think I was the only person in St. Pat's College that was determined to be on that 1 o'clock train from Connolly Station every Friday because I loved home. And I don't think in all the 5 years I was in St. Pat's, I ever stayed one weekend in Dublin. I just love home.
Really? So you didn't really get that student experience?
No, and I would like nearly cry on Sunday evenings having to go back on the orange train to Dublin. I loved home, and also I had my classes down there as well, and like all my friends, and we'd always be going out dancing at the weekends or doing something, so I'd cry if I had to miss it.
So do you go clubbing like most people your age would have done over the last 10 years? Would you go to a nightclub on a Saturday night? Or
not anymore.
Even at 19, 20?
Well, at 19, 20...
Or was that you went because you had to rather than because you wanted?
I went because that's where my friends were going.
Okay.
That were from... Like, I have two categories of friends. I have the friends who aren't
people
into...
People you like and the people you don't.
No, the friends who are like into the trad. And they're the people like that I will be closest to because I spend most of my time with them. And then there's the friends that I went to school with or college with. And obviously, they're from a totally different background. So, yeah, I'll go maybe once a year to a nightclub if I have to.
For someone's birthday. But the others, you'd rather be jiving at the crossroads.
Yeah, yeah. Or just at a session or... I don't know. I'm happy to go to a pub and listen to a good band. Like, but I'm just... I don't have any time for nightclubs where you can't hear each other.
I think you're getting old.
Or maybe. I've always been old.
That's a sign that you're getting old. I've been there for about 10 years. It's fine. Okay. End of college, 2010. Mm-hmm. And now we're getting into the juicy stuff. You kind of made a pretty big splash, definitely on these parts, on mm-hmm. a show called the All-Ireland Talent Show, which any Irish listeners would probably be familiar with. It was a relatively big event back Sunday nights, watching the show, and you had a group of dancers on that.
That's right. I had a group from Sligo, Leitrim and Roscommon. There was 10 of us, and I actually wasn't meant to be on it myself. Myself and Michael weren't meant to be a part of that group at all. And two of the children that were meant to be a part of it pulled out, and that's how we ended up doing it.
Because it did look slightly funny. Eight children and then two adults.
Like, we were the mommy and daddy of everybody. But no, I was glad I did it. And it was, I think, the best part. There was two things. One, it totally pushed the Shannos dancing further around Ireland. And second was, three things. It blew up my classes, which was fantastic. And the third thing was just the pride of the area. Not even just Leitrim. I mean, like Sligo and Roscommon too. They were so proud. And even today, people still say to me, oh, you're the group from the talent show. And sometimes it's like absolute cringe when you watch it back. You're like, oh God, what are we doing? But you know,
I think everybody's a bit like that. I think if you look back to any of those shows.
But still, like, no matter how much, I think it's just looking at us and looking how immature we are, even though it's not that long ago. And even the routines that we choreographed, it's like, oh, you know, what are we wearing and what are we doing? But no, I'm definitely glad we did do it because it was just such a proud moment for us as well. And there's one man in particular called Sean Gilrain from Ballinaglera. And he is definitely the proudest Leitrim man I know. And he, every time he meets me, he goes, oh, do you remember that time on the All-Ireland Talent Show? And the doors opened and you were standing there and the Leitrim crest was blazing behind you.
He remembers it better than you do.
Yeah, that's for sure.
That's a really weird situation. I've had people come up to me since I came back from the cycle and they're like, do you remember when this happened and that said that? And I'm like, nope. And they're like, well, you put it on Facebook, so it must have happened. And I'm like, well, obviously, I can't remember. But
I know.
It's really weird when that happens. But nice all the same that people have that kind of interest.
Oh, yeah. No, it is lovely. It was lovely. And it was, like, you've no idea how many people got behind us for that. You couldn't go anywhere. And people made posters for us on the sides of the road. There was, like, cardboard cutouts of us on everywhere. It was lovely. It was a bit like, totally, if anybody else came to the county, I'm sure they were like, this is ridiculous. But for our county, it was really important.
And you say it blew your classes up. So
that's
like,
right.
What are we talking in terms of improvement? Like, are you talking about doubling, quadrupling?
Oh, well, it went from like about, I suppose, between 70 and 100 kids to about 500 kids. So it was a huge jump in numbers.
And was it at that point that you kind of realised that maybe there was a business opportunity?
No,
for you?
Not at all. It wasn't until about 2 years ago. Because I was always very, I don't know, it's just the way I was brought up. I need to have a real job. This is the route I need to go. So I became a primary school teacher. I was a primary school teacher in school. And this was just something that I loved doing as a sideline, teaching kids, promoting the dance, and hopefully a generation, like a good few generations, have missed out on Shadows Dance and it died out. So I was trying to just rebuild it. So it was only 2 years ago before I was like, hang on a second. Why am I doing what I love rather than going to school every day, which I do still love, but I can always come back to that when my knees give up. So I'm going to keep dancing now for as long as I can and have school as an option later on.
Because that's what I really, that's the nucleus of what I want to talk about today, mm-hmm. because this podcast is about talking to people who are interesting, and you're definitely interesting, but also inspirational and motivational. And I think there's people listening to this who maybe have a skill that they don't see how they can make it a full-time career, or they don't mm-hmm. see how it can benefit anybody else. Whereas to some people, like wanting to dance around your kitchen table mm-hmm. is not something they can make a life at our career or a living from,
yeah.
but you've managed to do that. So I suppose I want to get into the nucleus of that decision in terms of when you made the decision that actually, do you know what, I'm going to concentrate on this business because it's what I absolutely love to do.
Yeah, it's about 2 years ago. I was in school full time and I was also trying to teach 5 nights a week. And as well as teaching 5 nights a week, like when I say 5 nights a week, I was traveling to Sligo, Leitrim, Roscommon, Mayo and Longford. And then at the weekends, then I could be in Cork or I could be in Italy. And it just was killing me.
It's just not sustainable, is
it? No, and everybody else was telling me it. But I was like, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm managing. And I hate to be told what to do. So, of course, I was just rebelling against them. But I did. Like, I really did wear myself down. And then I just said, right, well, one's got to give. And I knew if I gave up on my dancing that everything would disappear for what I'd worked for the past 10 years. So I just said, right, well, I'm going to focus on that. I always can come back to the teaching. It's always going to be there. And that's what I did. And I just went at it. And really, I think that when I started doing the club, I saw that when I went into it full time, I saw, well, actually, this is a living. And then more and more ideas that I kind of got towards the club, whether it be setting up groups or making a DVD or whatever, I realised that all these ideas I've been harvesting for the past 5 or 6 years and saying I'd love to do that actually could make money and were real things. And I surprised myself because I totally didn't believe in them. I was like, maybe down the road they'll do something, or wouldn't it be nice to have a DVD just for like the records for years to come when I'm long gone. But actually, they are money makers and they are ideas that are productive.
From a profile point of view, because as I said at the outset, you're pretty well known around these parts, not just for the talent show, which of course gave the whole area an enormous amount of pride, but then you also, I think you became only the second or third Leitrim Rose to actually get through the regional qualifiers and into the national finals down in Tralee in August, I'm going to say
2013.
And that's a huge deal as well, because as we had on last week's episode, Maria Walsh, the 2014 mm-hmm. Rose of Tralee, she told us all about how the Rose of Tralee is a festival that most Irish people, even if they slag it in mm-hmm. public, in private, everybody watches it. Yeah. Everybody knows who
they
won
do.
It.
Yeah.
It's front page news of the paper for the next mm-hmm. couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And for Leitrim to even be on that scale, because I think the only person I think who might have made it before you would have been Pamela Burke.
Yes.
So you were the Cross second the bridge, person, even though she's a Roscommon woman. So you're actually the first Leitrim person to actually be on the stage at that event, which is televised worldwide, and it's a huge event. What kind of difference did that make? Was that even bigger than the talent show?
Yeah, oh, for sure. Because it was just me, you know, and that, everything
how do you deal
was...
with that pressure?
Well, I don't know. It was brilliant. I loved it because everyone knows that's your one that never stops talking about Leitrim. Even in college, it was like, oh, the Leitrim girl. But yeah, it was just an opportunity for me to promote Leitrim. And really, like, I kind of fell into it. I really did fall into that
competition. Maria told us this story last week as well. That she only went to fill numbers.
Yeah.
And then got and then won it.
That's exactly. I was there to promote a festival that was coming up for the year in Carrick and Shannon. They were running several festivals, and that's my job was in the Leitrim Rose to promote that. But never did I think I was going to get through and continue through the regionals and get to the final. But it was a great experience, and really, for me, it was the best promotion I could have done for Leitrim. there was days, I have to say, there was days when my feet were so bad that I said, that's it, I'm not doing this anymore. Or from wearing high heel shoes, or just I had lost my patience a few times with it, just because it's quite a demanding festival for me when I have so many other things on. Every other girl loves it because they have normal lives and don't have to run away from everything else. But when I was doing it, I had a million other things that I was juggling as well. But the main thing was the film I was working on, which was Jimmy's Hall. So I was torn between one thing, like filming was on one morning that I was meant to be in Tralee and I'm meant to be at this crossroads scene in Jimmy's Hall. So I was finding it really hard. But really the one thing that kept me motivated and going was that I am shouting to this world about Leitrim and how fantastic it is.
But you're still doing to this day. No, Maria had the same situation. She was saying that as she was looking around the row of girls on the night, and they were saying it could be this girl, and Maria's like, oh, she'd be great. And then it goes, oh, the Philadelphia Rose, and she's like, oh, she'd be great. Oh, God, my boss is going to kill me.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, it was the same kind of thing. She obviously had a busy life, but I think that's what they look for, is they look for people who have done stuff and accomplished stuff. Anyway, enough about the Rose of Tralee. Let's go back to you and what you've been up to. So 2013, Rose of Tralee is over. Mm-hmm. You decide, I'm going to make a go of this in terms of the dancing school, and I'm going to, how difficult was it to hand in your notice in the school, or did you leave a permanent job?
No, I didn't leave a permanent job. This is the best part. So I literally walked away from my last maternity leave, and there were more jobs coming up that they offered me, but I just was like, no.
And how did the people in your life react to that? Specifically your parents, your mother, because Irish mothers are very much like, no, you're not doing that.
Yeah.
You got to have a job.
Well, I had definitely been talking about it for the year previous to that.
So you'd ease her into the idea.
I don't think she ever thought you'd actually do it.
Yeah.
But no, like for a good like few months after that, they'd be like, oh, here, there's a job coming up now, here or there, maybe you might apply for that. And I'd be like, no.
Did you even apply for any?
No,
it was a definite decision.
Today was my first day back in school, and I was only subbing today since last September. So, she was kind of not angry or anything like that. She just was totally looking out for me as, you know, as a proper job point of view and a pensionable job, and my dad too, and indeed my grandfather and everybody else. But I wanted to show them, they knew that I could make a living from dancing because I have been doing it. But they just were afraid that I pushed myself too far and that I might disappear for a few months on them as well, which they knew well would happen.
In terms of the, because I know you do tours as well. I know you were in Austria last month and you've been all over the place over the last few months. But in terms of the financial aspect, because that's what stops most people, is they worry about how they're going to put food on the table. They worry about how they're going to pay a lease or a mortgage or a rent. How much has the lack of a steady income, guaranteed steady income, affected you? Or has the dance school covered all your costs?
No, there are days. Like, I have to remember that my dance school only runs the school term. So once Christmas comes, I've no income. Once Easter comes or once summer comes, that's the end of my dance club income. So I have to work for myself after that and push to get different things. But yeah, I suppose it was something I did worry about. Not immensely now, I crossed my mind. But I very much live by two rules. Don't do things you don't want to. Do whatever you want that makes you happy. And what's for you won't pass you. And I just trust in that the whole time. I never worry, because it just gets you nowhere. And I'll always have school to go back to. And I have a very, very supportive family and husband-to-be. So, you know, that's a big strong point as well. I think when you have those people behind you, you don't have any fear, because you know they'll always be there for you. If everything fails, they're not going to go, told you so. You know, they're going to be there for you.
Will they really say a little bit if I told you so, though?
No, they won't. It's me going to them at the moment, told you so.
Okay.
I don't need school. Yeah.
You mentioned the DVD earlier, and that was a project you came up with last summer. What was the nucleus of that? What was the motivation behind the DVD?
Oh, God. It's quite a political one. Everybody thinks that my style of dancing that I do is from Connemara, because that's where it survived mainly. And everybody says, Odwina, you're from Connemara, are you? Or did you learn your dancing from Connemara? And I didn't. Shannon's dancing, or so they call it, was once danced all over Ireland. And it was like hugely popular here. Everyone did it. Every second person that came out of Arigna Mines did it. And the music was really strong around here as well, around Ballinaglera, all across Stephen Éireann and the Arigna Mountains, around Drumshambo. So it was something that I wanted to show people, that it's actually, I learned from my area, and I'm influenced, the way I dance, I'm totally influenced by the music of our area. And that was the real purpose of it. Now it's both, it's a tutorial and in a historical aspect to it. So, yeah.
And in terms of the production of that, did you have supports or did you have help?
Oh, I did, for sure, yeah. So I was funded by the Leitrim Enterprise Board. They covered the costs, most of the costs for me. And then I covered the other half myself. And it was made completely in Leitrim. It was kind of like a tourist kind of thing as well, because I filmed the whole thing outdoor.
Yeah, that's what I love, because I know, yeah. I saw images of you at the time on top of Seymour, right, and yeah. some pretty other iconic locations around the mm-hmm. county. Did that pose problems in terms of the actual...
Big time.
Who's lugging the cameras and stuff up the top of Seymour?
God love them, yeah. There was two German lads working with me, and one of them had never encountered windburn before.
Nice.
And after, I'm telling you, we were 14 hours on top of Seymour. And by the time we finished 14 hours on top of Seymour, he came back down off a glowing red. And yeah, it was interesting. And also, like, we were above at Sean McDermott's cottage one day, and we needed to film an intro, like a 2-minute intro. And by the time the sun came out, he'd set up his camera, and by the time we're ready to go, it'd rain again, and he'd take all down again. So that posed major problems, that's for sure.
One other thing you do that I quite like is the old school jiving, or shanos, for want of a better word, the jiving at the crossroads event that mm-hmm, you run. Is that the right name for it?
Dance at the Crossroads, yeah.
Dance at the Crossroads, yeah. I'm thinking of an old book by John Waters you may or may not be familiar with.
No.
It's an old political thing. Anyway, long story. But so Dance at the Crossroads up in Efferna, it's a very rural part of the county.
Yeah.
And you basically recreate
a crossroads dance.
A period festival.
Yeah, well, Efferna is just up the road from me. And we always had a bonfire at our house every bonfire night. I think, what a date is it? 23rd of June?
Something like that, yeah.
I think it's 23rd. We used to always have those at our house. And then when I got involved with the making of the film of Jimmy's Hall, and the more research I did into it, I read that they used to have a crossroads dance for Jimmy there when he came home from America. So I was saying, well, wouldn't it be lovely if we moved our crossroads dance, which was down at my house, right beside my house, where we already had musicians and food and stuff. Wouldn't it be lovely if we moved it to the crossroads where I used to be on? So we did that, and...
Well, you didn't just do that. It blew up.
Yeah, well, it really did. This year was ridiculous. What I did was I put it on the Observer 3 years ago and just said to everyone to come in 1920s clothes, if you have them. And a lot of people still dressing it around Efferna. And
you won't be thanked for that comment.
And also, it brings some wood for the fire. And what else did I tell them? Oh, and all musicians and singers and dancers, welcome. So it really was a shout out and a total chance of the arm, because I didn't know what musicians were going to show up, if any were going to show up, and then we'd have 50 dancers waiting to dance. But it actually turned out lovely, and people brought homemade, you know, bread and scones. And then this year was the third year of it, and I barely advertised it at all, and it totally
It's kind of become an institution now on Midsummer Eve.
Yeah.
You go to Efferna for the
yeah,
dance.
And we've been blessed with the weather the past 3 years, because if it rains, that's it. Like,
game
yeah,
over.
That's it, yeah. But no, we're very lucky, and we've great support of people up around Efferna as well that come with their bales of hay for people to sit on. And it's lovely. It's a real, like, and sometimes people come round and say something like this to my father, go, she must have made a fortune the last night. And it's not like you can charge people to come to the crossroads. There's no money involved in it. And then people come and say to me, I'll set up a stall for food and I'll give you €100 if you let me set up there. It's not about that at all. Like, you know, it's not about money. It's about
a
keeping
community
it.
Thing.
It's totally a community thing. There's no money changes hands, not for the musicians.
I think people are naturally suspicious when there's no money involved.
Totally, yeah.
It's like, well, why are they doing it? Because they wouldn't do it.
Exactly.
I think it just says a lot of volumes about the person who actually gets off their ass and does something for other people,
yeah,
with absolutely no return.
There's no
expectation.
No. Only the reward of saying, it did happen, here are the photographs, you know. And some of them made it into the Irish, I think it was Irish Independent from Brian Farrell. And just
am I right
so
in saying you made the front page of one of the national papers?
I can't remember.
I can't remember it yet.
Brian, I can't.
The modesty is coming through now.
No, but it's just lovely, so that in like 100 years' time, like, what I'm trying to do now is I'm trying to find old pictures of the crossroad dances that were there. My grandfather's 97 now, and he tells me, he came from Efferna, and he tells me about, you know, stuff that went on there. And I'd love for people in 100 years' time to say, oh, my granddad was at that crossroads dance that Edwina ran. I'd like that. Yeah.
So a bit of a legacy. You're thinking
not,
about
not that.
You're very young that. To be thinking about legacy.
Not even that, but just that people remember them, that that it's not a tradition that dies away. You know, because it's a great tradition. Why let it die away when we have it? Because no other country does it, you know.
I want to go back to the Rose of Tralee for a moment. Obviously, mm-hmm. you became effectively an ambassador for Leitrim on a national level, and the Rose Tour brings you around all the different counties, yep. and it gives you a huge platform to talk about that sort of stuff. You even got to dance, a brush dance, if I'm not mistaken, on the stage in the Dome. How did that go down? I know it's something you've done since you've done for years, and it's normal to you and
it's
your friends.
It's normal to me. To be honest, I wasn't. I was like,
it got mentioned everywhere at
it
the
did,
time.
It did, and I really didn't want to do, but RT were all for it. Firstly, because I knew that I'd have to wear trousers to do it, which would be a serious problem when you've got a dress on you. So I had to design my dress around this brush dance, because I had to pop off the bottom half so that I had a pair of trousers.
The dress?
Oh, Eileen Creamer, yeah, from Mull. And the second, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. And then the second reason I didn't want to do it was like, right, if there's people tuning in from all over the world, they're going to be like, and they don't understand the Irish tradition of dancing on a brush, they're going to be wondering, what is she doing? There's a girl dancing with a brush. And that's exactly what happened all over Twitter. Hashtag Leitrim, what is she doing with the brush?
But it wasn't I'm just thinking, it wasn't Dublin the previous year? Or was that even that year?
No, I know who you're on about, Siobhan. That was 2 years previous to that.
Okay, so you didn't quite get that that notoriety. Thankfully for you. But it did create that conversation about the dancing and about your home place, which is what you really wanted to do in the first place. So
yeah, that's for sure.
Are you a bit thankful to RTÉ?
No, I am. Oh, that's definitely. And it was a really good advantage because I know Dahi as well, outside of the Rose of Tralee. He was obviously our mentor for the All-Ireland Talent Show, but he hangs out on the same scene I do, as in he's really into trad music, and he's always at like the Milltown Malbay Fest and different things. So it was more of a having a chat with a friend. And he knew loads of stuff that I do, you know, so he knew exactly what to fish out of me. So that was a massive advantage as well.
So basically you're in on the inside track.
Yeah,
that's what you're telling us. How come you didn't win it then? Why are we not talking to the 2013 Rose of Tralee?
That's the other.
You were the bookie's favourite going into it though.
Yeah, that was pressure.
Why did that? How did that happen? Or do you know?
I don't understand.
Was it just that later people went crazy and were putting money on it?
I have no idea. Because it happened like... once the Portlaoise round was over, which was June, bank holiday. So that was like June, July, August before, and it was the favourite the whole way through. I don't understand betting because I don't do it, so I don't know how all these odds are accumulated. But
basically, the more people who think you'll win, the more favourite you are. That's kind of how it works. In layman's terms, it's a bit more complicated than that.
Oh, it was pressure not to win it. It was pressure as in, like, this is horrible, because everybody's talking about it and I'm with 32 other girls and I don't want to be going, oh, she's the favourite compared to this girl who's second favourite. I really hated that aspect of it, being compared to the others. And
but
for
is
them
that not
to
the
know,
whole point of the Rose of Tralee?
Oh, I know, but I wasn't there for that. And even just like the escorts going, oh, she's favourite now, she's in there now. And you know, like, when there's other girls there that you're really good friends with, I think it's horrible.
How many of those girls are you still in contact with?
I'm still in contact with three of them.
Only three?
Yeah. I'm desperate. My best friends will tell you. She's desperate.
Well, I know, trying to set up this interview, it's taken about 3 or 4 weeks just to get a yes. Well,
that's
not
right.
A yes. You give a yes straight away and then it's like, I'm busy.
Yeah, my friends know that I'm always there, but that I'm a disaster for keeping in contact. And sometimes then, like every maybe 5 months, they'll get a text message that's 20 text messages long for me filling them in on everything. But that's where social media comes in handy. And
yeah, so it's basically, if you want
know.
Me, find me on Facebook.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Yeah.
Follow my Instagram feed, it's grand.
But we do, for the Rose of Tralee, we do have like a 2013 Rose page and people write there the whole time. And it's lovely because even though you're not talking to them, someone might say, just got engaged or just had a baby or, you know, just got married and put up their pictures there. So you technically, you still follow it, you know, and you still keep in contact with everyone.
So you can basically
stalk
these people without actually engaging with them unless you choose to. Yeah, I'm not sure if that's a good thing. I wouldn't be advertising that at all. I want to get on to some of your charity work as well, because obviously through your teens, most of the dance teaching you did was on a voluntary basis,
yes,
until it kind of became a career for you. But you're very involved, I know, from social media, mm-hmm. from being aware of you on social media to see what you've done, particularly in Chernobyl with the Adi Roach Foundation. Or is it Chernobyl?
Chernobyl Children International.
And I know on recording, I know I actually get their emails, and I know they actually had a bit of bad news yesterday.
That's
children passed away. But what's your involvement with that organisation?
I first got involved with them. Actually, Chernobyl has been kind of something previous to the Rosa Tralee that kind of had been on my mind for a while, but I never actually realised it. It's something that's always been there because my aunts used to take children from Belarus during the summer and mind them. And when I got involved with the Rosa Tralee, really one of the things that really motivated me was when you become a rose, you get asked to go on a trip as a volunteer, if you would like to work in the orphanage in Vesnova. And that, I think this, out of the whole Rose of Tralee thing, this is the number one thing that happened to me because of the Rose of Tralee. So I went with a bunch of, I suppose it was about 20 of us, of roses and escorts in 2013, I think it was, the end of 2013, to Vesnova Children's Mental Asylum and volunteered there. And I've been going back since a good bit. Now, the first time I ever went, I work, like, obviously my job during the day is working with kids, and then I go from that to my dancing classes with kids. So my life is just spent never with adults, always with children.
That could
Hence
be a good
why
thing.
I am the way I am. and to go to Vesnova and see the way things were over there just took a serious toll on me. And I just came home half the person I had left to go there. And it took me a good 6 months before I could talk about the situation or before I even felt like I was back to my normal self again mentally. It really, really rattled me. Now, it rattled other people too, but I don't think they were half as affected. I just cried the whole time I was over there. I cried for the whole thing and I couldn't eat. And I think it was just that I never had witnessed anything like that before. But since I've gone back there every time, I haven't cried once. And I am so much more better and more prepared for it. And I look forward to going. So
I know at the time it was harrowing.
Yeah.
But do you find that you've changed because of the experience?
Oh, for sure. I came home being very angry towards children here. If some child said to me, I didn't get my PlayStation or something, like, not in an aggressive way, but just, I was just like, oh, you've no idea.
Problems.
Yeah. And they really, it's not just children. Nobody here, no matter how much I can tell them, has any idea until you go there and see it for yourself. Nobody does.
I haven't had in some respects, the pleasure of witnessing that firsthand. Mm-hmm. It's on my bucket list of things to do. But
yeah.
On my cycle, I got to go through India,
mm-hmm.
where you're going into towns with hundreds of thousands of people living in it that you've never heard of, you never will hear of. Mm-hmm. And probably most of the town, the people living in it, hundreds of thousands of people, have never even handled money.
Yeah.
Have no idea about things. Stuff that we just take for granted, like the table or the chairs or electricity. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And I would imagine it's similar.
It's very similar. And sometimes I think it's a good thing that they don't know about it, what they don't have.
They're the happiest people I've ever met.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that's the same in Chernobyl, but they're just happy to be alive. They're happy to be with their families. They're happy. They're not thinking about a bill, or they're not thinking about how they're going to pay the mortgage this month.
It's the one thing I'd love to be able to communicate further with them. Like, a lot of the children, they don't speak English, and the children, or even the adults, I still refer to them as children, but they are adults, who do speak English, have learned it from volunteers going over and working there. But
how's your Ukrainian?
I have Google Translate when I go and I get it to speak to them. But
I think that's cheating.
Extremely. But I would love to be able to communicate further with them and really delve into their thoughts and, like, you know, just to see what they're thinking or how they view the world.
A completely sidetrack, but mm-hmm. kind of related. When you see movies like, say, James Bond, for example, one of the recent James Bond went to Chernobyl,
and
it's part of a kind of storyline in a movie, and they don't really delve into the... Does that annoy you? Or do you kind of say, well, at least they're talking about it?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I kind of go, oh, there's place I recognise, you know, that kind of way. But it's kind of good in a way that it's been shown. But the other aspect of it is that it's 30 years this year since it happened, the Chernobyl disaster, and people think that's it. It's 30 years ago, they've all recovered, But they haven't, like, it's not something that, you know, that happened, and everybody has grown and recovered since, like, since that day happened 30 years ago, there's the radiation fell. It's not going to leave. It's in the air, it's in their soil, it's in their animals, it's in the food they eat, and it's in them. And it's there forever. And the people that were exposed to that radiation that day, which was millions, all have genetic markers. And when they have children, it mightn't appear in the next child, but when that child has a child, maybe it'll appear there. So they all have genetic markers that are there forever, and that's never going to fizzle out or wear down. It's just there permanently. And that's something that people don't know about and have forgotten, I suppose, that, you know, it's always going to be there. And really, to be honest, it's a lot got to do with the Belarusian government as well. There's a lot we can't say about them. Yeah.
Okay, we're not going to put ourselves on record anyway.
No.
People who might be listening to this and who might be interested in getting involved, not getting involved, but in replicating what you've done in terms of following your passion and following your want, what mm-hmm. you want to spend your time doing rather than what you have to spend your time doing. What pieces of advice would you give to someone who's in that situation, who maybe has a pet project or a hobby that they could see moving towards, or they mm-hmm. see other people making a living out of, and they'd like to replicate it? Give me three pieces of advice that you would
allocate time. It's just allocating time for it, because that was my biggest problem. I kept pushing it and going, oh, it's not going to work. But if when I did leave school and made time for it, it does work. And it just takes time, passion, and really a positive attitude. If you're constantly doubting it and wondering, is it going to work, you just have to go for it. Like, I've done several things that have flopped, and you just have to go, right, well, that didn't work. Now I'm going to move on to the next thing that I have an idea for and move on to that. And there's loads of stuff. Like, I'm 28 now, and looking back, when you're 16 or 17 and you're doing your leaving cert and you're made to choose what you want to do for the rest of your life, then it's such a difficult decision. And I went into primary school teaching because I knew I would enjoy it. But now, looking back, there are several other things I would love to do. And, like, I'm hoping to go back to college and maybe do production in film or something, or even directing, or even sometimes, like, making movies myself. That would be something I'd love to go down that line. But just because I'm 28 doesn't mean that I'm not going to do it. So, totally, if there's something that you want to do and you've a passion for it, then just do it. Simple as. That's the easiest way to say it.
Number one. We got number two.
That was two and three. Yeah, positive attitude. Just go and do it and make time. Yeah, that would be my three motivational aspects.
What does the future hold for you, for the dance classes, for mm-hmm. where do you see yourself ending up in a couple of years' time?
Yeah, well, I have a few different projects.
A small matter of a wedding, I suppose.
Oh, gosh, yeah. A new house. I keep forgetting about that.
Michael probably wouldn't appreciate that.
No, he forgets about it too, believe me. Everybody else is reminding us. We've nothing done for that, but it's just a matter of... It's only one day of the year.
You're just going to show up on the day. I think you're probably the most relaxed bride I've ever seen.
Yeah, well, you should hear all the other people. You know, those people you have to deal with for weddings. Like
Parents.
The hotelier and stuff. And they're like, oh God, are you going to do anything? But no, it's just one day of the year. And then that's fine. Anyway, we're practically married. We're together so long. But I have the dance club. I'm hoping to expand further. I have, at the moment, 7 people working with me in the club. So they're helping me run classes weekly. I'm setting up a project called The Dance Parlour, which is not just about Irish dance. It's about dance worldwide. And it's basically a meeting point or a hub for dancers across the world. So I will be employing people to work with me, record tutorials and put them online, and then people can access them from wherever they want in the world. Because it's one of my biggest problems at the moment is people ringing me from Tokyo and say, can you come over here for a week and teach dance? And it's, or even I've had a request for weekly classes one time in New Zealand. It's just not possible to do that.
I'm sure you could do it if the flights. Yeah, well, take you a week to get over and back.
I wouldn't fancy it. But I've done a few trials through Skype and things like that. But Skype, sometimes the internet just isn't fast enough in Leitrim at the moment. So I said, right, I need to set up online pre-recorded classes. So that's the first project. But I'm working with dancers from all around the world in different styles. second project.
Well, have you got a launch date on that? Or?
Oh, it yeah, it's meant to be April. Please God. I'm working towards it. And we'll like I was saying, April. I should take my own advice and make time. And then the second project that I'm really working on is getting dance more into primary schools. So dance is part of the primary school curriculum, but it's very seldom done. It's part of the physical education curriculum. So I'm trying to pre-recorded tutorials for the whiteboard so that the children can log in if it's raining outside, not see it as a class, but just something that they can just log in whenever they want if it's raining or if they have a 10-minute break when they're finished their work early, and can log in and learn how to do the brush dance or be whatever style of dancing they want. So that's the next project. And what else am I doing? And then I'm working on shows. I'm working on a group from Quebec at the moment, and I'm touring a lot with them, so I'm about to head off in May again for a month in Quebec, and again in September and October.
In Canada, very nice.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know you've been to Austria this year as well?
I was just in Austria. We did a tour of Austria, Germany, Italy, and Switzerland just before Christmas, yeah.
As you do,
yeah. It's I lived the good life.
Is this what you would have imagined yourself doing 5 years ago?
Not really, because I was still in, I need to be in the primary school, you know, that I need to be doing that. So I didn't imagine that. But when I started to go towards dancing, then I was like, well, that's what I want to do. And there's even more stuff I have in my head that I want to get into. I want to get into more styles of dance. And really, my goal in life is to recreate a different type of dance show, an alternative river dance that's better.
Oh, that sounds optimistic. Well, not optimistic. Optimistic is the wrong
it
word.
It is optimistic.
It sounds very challenging.
It is challenging. Funding is a challenge, big time. And also, I haven't...
You seem pretty resourceful, though.
Yeah. No, any millionaires. I'm trying to... I still haven't seen the show
I only
fully.
Deal with billionaires, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I haven't seen the show fully in my head. I have an idea, and it's still very raw. And a lot of the dancers that I want in it are still very young. So I need them. But I am planning within the next year or two to have a mini show on the go if it's just around Ireland for 1 week. Just to test the waters. But dance shows are massive in Europe and worldwide at the moment, and they're all the same format. They're all Riverdance, and Riverdance is going how many years now? Was it 25? Was it
1994?
Yeah, okay, that long.
The Eurovision. Ireland won the Eurovision. Yeah. 94. Charlie McGettigan,
that's
local
right
man.
Well, it's the same format since that day, so I'd like to rattle that up a bit and show them what else there is out there from Ireland.
Sounds very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy's Hall, you mentioned in the course of the interview as well, and I'd like to know a little bit more about that, because it was a feature-length movie shot in Leitrim, around Leitrim,
yeah.
About a Leitrim man. Tell us a bit about Jimmy Glatton, first of all.
Okay, so Jimmy was a man from Efrina, which is just up the road from my home place, and Jimmy first built a hall. Around the 1920s, the Black and Tans burnt down the hall in Gowell, and it was the hall where everybody went to socialise. And when it was burnt down, they had nowhere to go. So out of his own money and on his own land, with the help of the community, he built a hall. He was ran out of that by the Catholic Church. He returned home. He went to America. He returned home again in the 1932, I think it was, and saw, you know, that the hall was still there. People still had nowhere to go. And really, the community kind of bullied him in to open it up again. But he wanted that to happen anyway. So he did, and in that hall he ran dances, brought in some jazz bands, which was all the rage in America at the time. He brought home a gramophone, had the likes of Ella Fitzgerald playing on it. Not just that, he was also a person who ran several different styles of classes, but it was also a place where he held court. A lot of landlords were pushing people off their land back then if they couldn't pay the rent, or were doing cattle runs, running their cattle off their land into other people's fields. And he really stood up for the local people. But I think the main thing that annoyed the Catholic Church was that he had men and women dancing together that weren't doing the typical type of Irish dance. They were doing Lindy Hop, which is a beautiful style of dance, but if you see Lindy Hop, yeah, the priest definitely
this
didn't.
Physical contact.
The priest definitely didn't appreciate it. But they basically, there are other several stories. My grandfather came from there and was 13 at the time, and he has some fantastic stories. And indeed, when Ken Loach and Paul Lafferty were writing the script for the film, they came and interviewed him in 1932. Around that time, when he reopened the hall, they fired shots into the hall at the people dancing. And the priest would stand outside the hall taking people's names that were going in and read them out at Mass the next day. And in the end, I think it was on Christmas Eve one year, I think it was 1933, they burnt the hall down. And then Jimmy went on the run because they went to De Valera about him and told him that he actually had acquired an American passport while he was in America. And they labelled him the undesirable alien.
De Valera had an American passport as well.
Yeah, coincidental. And when he went on the run then for about 4 months, and he was eventually captured and deported. So he was the only Irishman to ever be deported from Ireland, from his own country. Yeah, interesting story. It really is. Like, there's so much more you could go into, but it would take a whole day.
But the movie, effectively, a couple of years ago, I know you choreographed the whole thing. Were you in it as well?
Yes. I was very slightly, not by choice. I was just dumped in it one day where you don't have a choice, yeah. I was working with a second choreographer, so I was in charge of the Irish dance scenes, and then there was Chantal Carey who was in charge of the Lindy Hop scenes. So previous to this, before the film had been made, I was working with Donal O'Kelly. He had put the whole show together in a play. So the idea of the play was we went to dance halls around Leitrim with the band. Keela were the main members of the band, and the first half of the show was the play, and the second half, Jimmy, Donal O'Kelly, would stand up as Jimmy and invite the audience to come into his dance hall and dance. So the second half would be a dance and the band would play. And he sent the script, or sent the idea and story to Paul Laverty, who he was friends with, and that's how it came about. But it's definitely one of the best things I've ever done in my life. It was one of the best to work with Ken Loach. Is just...
That was actually my next question, because obviously Ken Loach is very well known for The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which won, I think, the Palme d'Or in Cannes. And one of his very next projects, you're one of the main people on a local level, at least, working on that.
Yeah, it was... He's an incredible man. I just can't praise him enough. He's just such an understanding man and fair. He sees everything from both sides. And also, like, from the very first day I met him, like, there was other people who came in with me that might have auditioned for him dancing. And he remembered, like, 6 months on, we'd be standing in a full dance hall and he would address everybody by their first names.
That's a phenomenal talent.
He knew everyone. It is. It really is. And there's just so many things of happy memories from him. And he is incredible. He's in his 80s and he would start at 7 o'clock that morning, and at 11 o'clock that night he would still be going with his one camera, having ate only bananas for the day, and we'd all be dying. And he would order in Domino's pizza from Sligo and the Larry Loads for us. He was just a great man, with a great vision, and really wants things to just be, you know, if something deserves to be told, a good story, he will. But I'm so glad I did it. And the other thing was that if he's filming in County Leitrim, he will employ everyone he can from County Leitrim. You know, he doesn't go for the false effect. He wants you to speak like a Leitrim person, and everybody there too, and really feel the real
slipping
deal.
And sliding all over
it was lovely. We definitely found the land for it anyway.
In terms of this podcast and what we do every week on the podcast, we'd like to finish off the show. Well, I like to finish off the show by asking a very simple question. Mm-hmm. What can the listeners of this podcast do to help you?
Oh gosh, maybe take my advice in regards to doing what they want to do. I think that's the best. Well, you can all come to my dancing classes and stuff and log on to the dance parlour. I'm only joking. Really, I think the most rewarding thing for me from this would, if people took my advice and followed in my footsteps and did what they want to do, rather than doing what maybe everybody else thought was best for them, or even thinking, having great ideas in your head and always saying, well, that's a great idea. Because myself and my boyfriend used to sit so many times.
Fiance.
I never call him that. When we're watching like Dragon's Den, and we're always like, I've a great idea, I'd love to go to that with it. And then we'd say, oh, they'd never go with it. But, you know, why are we saying that? We see things all the time appear on Facebook or on Kickstarter or on websites saying, look at this invention, they're after making millions. And it's the simplest little thing in the world. Like the cup, the thing that covers your teacup. And, you know, those...
I haven't seen that
cardboard
for oh yeah yeah the tea. Little cardboard yeah for Starbucks or whatever
exactly. Look how simple that is.
They made millions off
yeah that. Exactly
or the so, red cup
that That's right.
You know, the Red Cup, yeah. That's trademarked as well.
Yeah.
And everyone wants the Red Cup, the red... so that you pay them, you buy it off that company.
You see how simple these ideas are. So I would say follow your ideas, because you just never know where they might end up.
She's not really joking about the come to her dance classes and go to the dance parlour.
Yeah, well, you'll get really fit and have a really good time as well.
Well, listen, Edwina, it's been an absolute pleasure to have an hour in your company. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us on the Breath Hearing Show.
Thank you.